Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, October 15th, 2024, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument program on Garland versus Van Deerstock, which was argued last week before the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I am an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief, but if you'd like to know more, you can access his impressive full bio at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Pete Patterson, who is a partner at Cooper & Kirk, where his practice includes appellate litigation, constitutional litigation, commercial litigation, and administrative law. In addition, Mr. Patterson, for a number of years, taught an appellate litigation clinic at the University of Cincinnati College of Law. As part of his work at the clinic, Mr. Patterson represented indigent clients in habeas and criminal matters for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. He also has extensive experience in complex matters involving important questions of constitutional, statutory, and administrative law, and he frequently has represented plaintiffs in cases alleging constitutional or statutory violations by federal, state, and local government officials. He has also represented plaintiffs in class action litigation against corporations and the federal government, and he argued on behalf of the respondents in this case. And I'll leave it there. A last note, and then we're going to start off with some opening remarks. Throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature so they'll be accessible and get to that extended portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Patterson, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and thank you for having me and everyone for attending. I'm pleased to be here. I will start with just a short overview of the case. I hope to reserve most of this time to answer people's questions they may have. But this case is a statutory interpretation case primarily, and it's based on a provision of the Gun Control Act that defines a firearm as a weapon, including a starter gun, that is designed to or may readily be converted to expel a projectile by the action of an explosive, or the frame or receiver of any such weapon. And so breaking that down into those two parts, the first part of the definition really is the definition of a gun, the standard common definition of a gun, with the exception that Congress added other types of weapons that could readily be converted to function as guns. And the example given in the statute is a starter gun, and there were certain specific starter guns that were before Congress that essentially were guns. They had the frame of a handgun, and all that needed to be done was to put on a handgun barrel or drill out the filled barrel on those starter guns to turn those into guns. So that's the first part. The second part is the frame or receiver. The frame or receiver is basically the middle part of the gun between the barrel where the round comes out and the stock or butt end of the gun that is at the end of it. And it houses the parts that make a gun operate, basically, that enable the explosion and that direct the energy from that explosion out of the barrel of the gun. So that was Congress's design, and that's basically how things operated from 1968 until 2022 at ATF. And then in 2022, ATF promulgated a regulation that expanded the definition in two key ways. First, ATF said, we're not only going to regulate a frame or receiver, but we're going to count as a frame or receiver items that may readily be converted into a frame or receiver, despite Congress not putting that language in the frame or receiver part of the statute. And then ATF also said, we're going to regulate collections of parts that are not weapons before being converted into a firearm, and that do not include a frame or receiver, which is the one part that Congress regulated in the Gun Control Act. And so the consequence of this is that items that up until now had been freely accessible to individuals, desiring to make their own firearms at home, which has always been something that people have been allowed to do and has not been regulated by the federal government. Now, in order to acquire the parts that are regulated by this regulation, it has to go through the what would be required to actually buy a firearm. And so that's additional regulatory burden, and ATF predicted in advance of promulgating this regulation that it would put 42 out of 43 unlicensed manufacturers in this area out of business. So it really was quite a striking change and expected to have a big impact on a market that had developed based around 50 plus years of ATF regulations. So I will, I think that gives kind of a sense of the issues in the case, and I'm happy to address questions that people may have about it after hearing that introduction.
Got it. Well, thanks so much. Appreciate sort of that primer. As I'll issue the reminder to our audience, if you do have questions, you can put those in the Q&A. But to kick things off, I have a couple of my own that I'd love to pose. Before we get into sort of oral argument and how it went, I'd love to do a little bit more on this background concerning how we got here and some of the grammar. I got to read through the transcript of the oral argument. There were a couple of like pieces of legislation or regulations that were referenced that I'd love a bit of background if you don't mind. So first, what are the relevant statutes and regulations? And I had a couple, chapter 44, 922A13 and 924 were all referenced in oral arguments. So if you could give a little on each of those, that'd be fabulous.
Yeah, so the relevant statute is the Gun Control Act of 1968. And that is kind of the major legislation that governs the commercial market for firearms in this country. Also, has criminal applications as well. That altered prior federal law, which was the Federal Firearms Act, was the most pertinent one, which had defined a firearm as any weapon designed to expel a projectile by the action of an explosive and any part or parts of any such weapon. So what Congress did in the Gun Control Act of 1968 is that it expanded the first part of the definition to include those weapons that could be readily converted to firearms, but then contracted the second part of the definition because they said it would be too unwieldy to regulate every part of a firearm and said we're only going to regulate the frame or receiver. And that statute, I mean, there have been some amendments to that statute since 1968, but none to the relevant parts of the statute for purposes of this case, the definition of firearm. ATF, shortly after the statute was enacted in 1968, promulgated a rule defining a frame or receiver as the part of a firearm that houses the hammer, bolt or breech block, and the firing mechanism. And that regulatory definition, it didn't say anything about ready conversion or anything of that nature. Didn't say anything about parts kits. And that is the regulation as it stood on the books until 2022 with the regulation in question. And all those questions about Chapter 44, 924, those sorts of things, those are the criminal applications under, Title 18 USC, and mostly in Section 922 is where there are prohibited acts like felon in possession of a firearm, individuals receiving a firearm into their state of residence from outside of state. And then Section 924 sets forward the criminal penalties for those sorts of activities. So that is what adds, importance. This is not just about regulating the commercial market. It's also about whether, individuals are committing crimes or not, which can be based on very precise lines, as we may get into in the Gun Control Act.
Got it. Thank you. That's all very helpful. Next sort of background piece before we move into oral argument itself, who are the respondents in this case and how do they have standing?
Yes, the respondents are, there were the original plaintiffs, which were two individuals who have purchased these sorts of items and would wish to continue to purchase these sorts of items without having to, get them through the mechanisms that the regulation allows, as well as a manufacturer of these items. And so they clearly, you know, all of them clearly have standing because this regulation impacts their conduct under this regulation. If the manufacturer wanted to continue selling these items, he would have to, or they would have to go through that regulatory process. And same with the individuals purchasing them, would have to go through the process for buying these, including that they would not be able to get them from outside of their home states directly. And then also the Firearms Policy Coalition, an organization, a membership organization, was also a plaintiff. And then there were several cases that were consolidated with this one, intervening, or I guess not consolidated, but intervening plaintiffs, including the Second Amendment Foundation, Defense Distributed, and other manufacturers of these items.
Got it. Thanks so much. Oh, we have an audience question asking about the Second Amendment implications of this. Obviously, this is a challenge of a regulation in accordance with a statute, and I don't believe the Second Amendment came up during oral argument, but nevertheless, there is some overlap. How is there overlap, and to what degree does the sort of constitutionality of potential infringements on Second Amendment rights play into the conversation being held here?
Yes, there was no Second Amendment claim before the court. As you indicated, there was a constitutional avoidance argument, which is a principle of statutory interpretation that says, you know, if we interpret a statute one way and it would present difficult or questionable constitutional issues, and it's, you know, reasonable to interpret the statute another way, that's a reason to interpret it that other way. And the Second Amendment implications here would be, you know, if we apply Bruin, we look at the plain text first, and it says you have a right to keep and bear arms. And if you right to keep arms, there is an implied right to acquire firearms by some way, and you can acquire them by buying them or by making them. And then so that the plain text is implicated, and then the question becomes, is there any historical tradition that would allow this sort of regulation on making firearms for personal use? And you know, the argument was there is no history that would support this. But ultimately, again, that was not directly presented in this case. And, you know, the court, our argument was, could avoid that question or even the possibility of that question arising as a follow-on to their decision if they were to interpret the statute as we think it should be interpreted, to not encompass these kits that aren't weapons and don't include frames or receivers, and that, or items that are not yet frames or receivers but can readily be converted to be frames or receivers.
Got it. On that note, there were three tests proposed. Yes, there's the readily convertible test, which the government's endorsing, and then you had two, one that's your preferred, and then say, hey, if you don't grant this, here's the next option. Could you give a little more background on what those each are and how they differ?
Yes, I will. I mean, our primary argument was that Congress did not put language like readily converted or designed to or readily restored, terms that are replete throughout the Gun Control Act and the, you know, Associated National Firearms Act, into the definition of frame or receiver. Congress just said frame or receiver. And as a matter of plain meaning, a frame or receiver is an item that can house these certain parts of a firearm. And so our primary argument is that unless and until an item is machined to the point where it can house those items, it's not a frame or receiver. And by machined, we mean like operations with tools. I think that argument, I use the analogy of a sculptor, you know, chiseling something from a stone, actually removing items from the material until it can house those items, that, you know, that's when something becomes a frame or receiver. That's, you know, seems to be what the statute has to say. It's a very bright line rule. Now, there, you know, to the extent the court were to disagree with that, we offered an alternative, which is the critical machining test. And what that is the test that ATF employed for decades until it changed the approach in this rule. And what that would do was focus on that part of the frame or receiver precursor item that would house those fire control components and have critical machining operations been done on those components. And I think I got a question at argument about that seems kind of made up. And my response was, it's not, because if we're looking for an alternative to something actually functioning as a frame or receiver, one place to look is the application of that language by the agency and the industry in a back and forth process over a period of decades. And this is the test that they arrived at. So this seemed to be the commonly understood definition of what a frame or receiver was. It reached a point of equilibrium. And therefore, that is a basis for finding that to be an alternative understanding of what a frame or receiver is. Now, the government's argument, or the government's alternative, is that a frame or receiver is an item that can readily be converted to a frame or receiver. And now there are several problems with that. I mean, one, as I've said, it clashes directly with the language of the statute, because when Congress wanted items that could be readily converted to an item to be covered, Congress put that language in there explicitly. So as a just interpretive principle, you see, if Congress puts certain language in one place and they don't put it in another place, that typically is important. So the government's argument must be that just as a matter of plain meaning, items that can readily be converted to another item are that item, just as a matter of meaning. But then you run into an issue with other parts of the Gun Control Act and the National Firearms Act, because there are many items that can readily be converted under the government's understanding of what that entails into items that are illegal or very heavily regulated. For example, as I said at argument, there are lower receivers for AR-15 semi-automatic firearms, perfectly legal, that the only machining operation that needs to be done on them to allow them to function as a machine gun receiver is to drill one hole. And so the government gives drilling one hole as kind of the paradigmatic example of a ready conversion. And while the government says we would not interpret that to apply to this semi-automatic receiver, and we would hope they wouldn't going forward, but it's hard to see as a matter of principle if that ready conversion language is implicitly present, that it wouldn't apply to that circumstance. So the critical machining operations test, on the other hand, avoids that problem, because the critical machining operation that needs to be done for that item to be a machine gun receiver is to drill that third hole, or that final hole. That's the only thing distinguishing it from a machine gun receiver. So we think our test is both more in accordance with the text of the statute, more in accordance with the history of how the statute has been interpreted, and also would have fewer practical problems presented down the road.
Got it. Thank you. One last note of that, and then moving to Loper and its impact on this case.
Yes.
Is the critical machining test the same as the 80% rule, or are they different? And well, if so, yeah. How do those
yes.
two work together?
Yes. The critical machining test is what led to the colloquialism 80% rule. That 80% rule was never an agency term, that was never formally accepted as a standard. I think it's just what people referred to it as, that basically is where the line was drawn. So yes, when people say the 80% rule, that is basically the same as the critical machining test, although it's kind of a shorthand, just common term for it, not the agency term.
Got it. Thanks so much. Well, we've had a couple of audience questions relating to the impact of the Loper-Bright decision yeah. on this piece of litigation. I assume it started before Loper-Bright was decided and now is being resolved afterwards. What was the impact of the abandonment of Chevron on the way this was argued, if at all?
Yeah, I don't think there was much impact. The government has never invoked Chevron in this case. And in fact, there's an Abramski decision from even earlier dealing with the application of the Gun Control Act to straw purchases. And the court in that case said this is a criminal statute. So what the agency did in the past or what they think it means has zero significance. So So this is, I don't think Loper-Bright has a big impact. I know there were some questions about that. And I think my response was all that we have to do to show that this rule is unlawful is that it's inconsistent with the statute. And because if it is inconsistent with the statute, then ATF is acting outside of its statutory authority. So Loper-Bright, I agree, is a very consequential decision, but just based on the way this case was litigated and argued, the fact that it's a criminal statute, it seemed not to have a big impact.
Got it. Thanks so much. Ani's question following up on that. The Solicitor in General informed the court the regulation didn't target parts. The act appears to be ambiguous. Would Loper-Bright have any impact on disallowing ATF's definition of parts?
I don't agree that the act is ambiguous and, you know, it doesn't target individual parts, but it targets collections, parts kits explicitly. And I don't think, you know, even if you held it were ambiguous, obviously under Loper-Bright, we don't defer to the government. The government has not invoked Chevron or any sort of deference in this case. And in fact, to the extent it's ambiguous, that would require a ruling against the government, because the rule of lenity says that if you get to the end of your statutory interpretation endeavors and there remains an ambiguity in the statute, then we hold that ambiguity against the government.
You mentioned sort of what needed to be proven in this. And actually, there was some discussion as to what the actual question in the case was, particularly since it's a facial challenge. Mm-hmm. Could you comment a little on the question or questions at issue in the case and the nature of this as a facial challenge vis-a-vis a as applied challenge and what that meant for the arguments that were put forward?
Yeah. So it's the questions were, again, there are two questions. One is the parts kit provision of the regulation lawful, and two, is the provision about readily convertible frame or receivers lawful? And the reason it's a facial challenge is because our position is that even if a collection of parts were readily convertible to function as a firearm, or even if an item is readily convertible into a frame or receiver, the answer to those questions are yes, that does not make it a firearm under the statute. So we're not arguing about the application of this rule to any particular kit or frame or receiver precursor. Instead, we're saying that under this rule, when the agency goes to decide whether an item is a firearm or a frame or receiver, the agency is asking the wrong questions and performing the wrong analysis. So on its face, the regulation is unlawful.
It. Thanks so much. On that note, we have an audience question asking about the readily convertible argument and the temporal aspect, because I know there was some disagreement as to the facts, whether like 21 minutes, 8+ hours, the amount of time invested in that. How does that affect the argumentation, and does it matter under your framework, the temporal aspect of conversion?
Well, not under the primary arguments that we've made. The primary arguments are, regardless of how readily convertible a kit is, if it's not a weapon before the conversion and it doesn't have a frame or receiver, it doesn't fall under Part A of the definition. And regardless of how readily convertible an item is into a frame or receiver, that's not a frame or receiver under Part B of the definition. So it really doesn't matter. We do have a vagueness argument and another constitutional avoidance argument with respect to vagueness, because the agency's definition of readily convertible is essentially inscrutable. They've listed 8 kind of qualitative factors that are unweighted, and then they've cited cases saying, okay, something is readily convertible when it could be converted in 3 to 12 minutes with a drill versus something was readily convertible after 8 hours in a fully equipped machine shop. So there's really no solid guidance given in the rule to people or anything to constrain the agency's discretion about what would be readily convertible. But in terms of, you know, there's no particular item that is at issue in this case as to whether, okay, if we were to accept the rule, would this item be readily convertible? There was some briefing and some argument about that, but that's not really what the case is about.
Got it. A next audience question asks about the underlying enforcement mechanisms. Are these ATF regulations implementing their interpretation of a criminal law? And if so, who's it enforced against? Buyers, manufacturers, possessors? Is it a permitting regulation for holders of Class 3 licenses? And depending on the answer to that question, does that have an impact on the interpretation of the statute?
Well, there are various enforcement mechanisms, and with respect to the ATF enforcing it directly, ATF can, like, for example, say a licensed person was selling these items, but outside of the requirements of the Gun Control Act, they could bring, you know, license revocation or other proceedings against that dealer. They also can bring, I believe, forfeiture actions against individuals or businesses that were selling these things in a manner inconsistent with their interpretation of the rule. But then also, this is, you know, the definition of firearm in Section 921A, which is what these regulations are interpreting, govern a lot of criminal laws. Again, the laws against receiving a firearm across state lines and, you know, receiving a firearm into your state of residence, all the, you know, felon possession, those types of statutes. So that is a reason why ATF's interpretation, even before Loeb or Bright, should get no deference, and why, to the extent there's an ambiguity under the rule of lenity, since there are criminal applications of this statute, would counsel in favor of ruling against the government.
Got it. Actually, following up on that, the next question is, as a criminal statute, has this ever been challenged as void for vagueness? And if not, what do you think about the chances for that argument?
There have been some void for vagueness challenges, I believe, in a case from 1971, I think it was in the Second Circuit, with respect to starter guns, that could be converted in 3 to 12 minutes with a drill. And the court said, no, you know, it's readily is not vague, particularly when you have the starter gun example singled out in the statute. And, you know, 3 to 12 minutes is readily. And so our challenge was not to readily in the statute, but rather as defined by the agency. If a court were to say, okay, we're going to use the starter gun example as kind of a baseline, 3 to 12 minutes with a drill, something on that order, that could solve a lot of the vagueness problems. But the problem is that the agency was not willing to take that sort of line in the rulemaking and instead cited that case. But then also, as I said, cases with 8 hours in a machine shop, they explicitly said in the rulemaking, we're not trying to provide guidance for people to avoid acting in accordance with the law, or we would call that complying with the law. But So yes, it's the vagueness issue, the way we conceive it, is with how the agency has interpreted readily and said, we're going to interpret readily. We're not saying that the readily term in the statute is necessarily vague.
Yeah. I'm still on OA, but breaking out a little bit from the details of the case. When arguing before a increasingly textualist / originalist court on a matter where both sides are claiming the text supports their argument directly, how does one navigate handling text and history? And is there agreement, at least in how the positions were advanced, regarding the factors the court should be considering? Text, congressional intent, history, common understanding, etc.?
Well, I think as a textualist matter, the text is what matters, and you can look at other things to the extent they inform the meaning of the text. But what you're really looking for is the meaning of the text in terms of whether there was agreement between the parties on what you look at. I'm not sure exactly. I think the government did argue a lot about this anti-circumvention principle, which is they're saying, well, if you interpret the text the way the respondents want you to interpret it, it's going to lead to circumventing Congress's purposes. So that can't be the right interpretation. You know, obviously, we don't agree with that here. And I think, as the court has said in prior cases, Congress didn't pursue to the nth degree its goal of controlling access to firearms in the Gun Control Act. And we can see that very clearly because Congress didn't regulate the secondary market of firearms. And according to ATF's own statistics, that secondary market is involved in 40% of ATF investigations into gun trafficking versus only 3% of privately made firearms. So if leaving that secondary market unregulated isn't cause for circumvention concerns, or that didn't upset Congress's purposes, then it should follow necessarily that interpreting the statute the way we think it should be interpreted here would also not be circumvention.
Yeah. Usually I'd round out sort of the oral argument question section with something about, were there any themes were you surprised to see? You argued at oral argument, right? So I'm guessing there's a little less of the surprise. Nevertheless, were there any themes that you found particularly interesting, or themes that weren't fleshed out fully that you were would have liked to see more fleshed out during oral argument?
I don't know. You know, it's hard to assess that. You know, you go into argument prepared for whatever comes, and you know, that's the way I approach it and view it.
Fair enough. Well, moving to the ramifications of the case, then, we have a question relating to the potential scope of this decision. So do you anticipate that the scope of the ruling could include 3D printed as well as purchased pre-manufactured firearm components?
I don't think it would include 3D printed. I mean, the only way it would be relevant to 3D printing, I think, is if someone were 3D printing the items that are subject to the regulation and then were selling those items. The rule does not purport to regulate, at least in the way that ATF has signaled to date, someone using their own 3D printer to print something from raw materials.
Got it. Well, broader implications, and again, this is usually where I'd ask, hey, what do you think the implications of both sides might be? I recognize you represent one side, so it's going to be a little skewed, but I'll still ask the balance questions. What are the implications of this case if the court agrees with the government? What businesses or individuals could be impacted?
Well, as the government had predicted in the rulemaking, they said, we think this is going to be devastating for this industry. This is going to put a lot of them out of business. You know, the FBI, which runs the background check system, asked ATF during the rulemaking, what do you think the impact on the background check system will be if this regulation goes in place? And ATF said, we don't think there's going to be a big impact because we think a lot of these companies are going to go out of business. So, so I think on the ATF's own telling, the impact is going to be kind of devastating this market that had grown up around decades of ATF regulatory activity.
Got it. And I'll ask the reverse question. What are the implications of the case if the court agrees with you?
Well, you know, it will essentially be a return to the status quo that existed before this rule was adopted. You know, there was the most likely remedy, the remedy, proper remedy was actually not before the court, but it likely would be vacatur of these two challenge provisions of this regulation, which means we would just go back to what existed before these regulations were promulgated.
Got it. Is there a third? I mean, probably not, but is there like a middle ground third option? It doesn't agree with fully either side, gives a sort of not squishy, but a blended answer?
Yeah, there's two provisions of this regulation that we've challenged. It's possible the court could say, yeah, we agree with the government on one of them and we agree with the challengers on the other. And so, you know, depending on how that looks, you could have either you're going back to the old regime on the parts kits or going back to the old regime on the frames or receivers.
Okay. Are there any industries or manufacturers that should be taking notice of the way that oral argument went in this case and the questions before the court that might not be directly impacted?
I think it's just interesting to any business or industry that's in a federally regulated space and that has very, you know, like the Gun Control Act, highly kind of detailed, worked out scheme, and to see, you know, how strictly that language is going to be interpreted.
Well, I Barring any other questions from the audience, I'll take host prerogative and end with the last one. Typically, I would end with the question of your prediction of the case, but instead I'll phrase it this way. What are the key or determinative points at issue that you're particularly tracking based on how oral argument went?
Well, based, I guess, on how oral argument went and just based on the arguments that we've made, I think for part A of the definition, the key question is one of these parts kits a weapon before it's converted? Because Congress regulated weapons that may readily be converted to a frame, to a firearm, functioning firearm. And then also with respect to part A, can something be a weapon under part A if it does not have a frame or receiver, given that that is, and that's however frame or receiver is defined. If the kit does not have a frame or receiver, given that that is the only part that Congress regulated, and then given also that in section 923I of the statute, it's on the frame or receiver of each firearm that is manufactured, that the serial number has to be placed. So those are kind of the key questions for part A. The key question for part B is whether something, simply because it can readily be converted to function as a frame or receiver, is a frame or receiver for that reason, when, you know, in our view, that's inconsistent with the ordinary meaning of frame or receiver. And it also is inconsistent with the statutory design, which repeatedly and in multiple places includes language like readily converted, readily restored, designed to, combinations of parts, all sorts of language that brings in something outside of the ordinary understanding of the item. But that language is absent in the frame or receiver definition. So those are the two key questions or two key categories of questions for the court to address.
Fabulous. Thanks so much. Any final comments you'd like to give either on any of the questions or the case in general?
No, just other than, you know, this case is a privilege to litigate and argue. It's my first argument before the court, so very happy to get the opportunity to do that. My privilege to have my family be able to attend. So that was a good experience. And we're just looking forward to see how the court answers these questions.
Sounds good. Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate you joining us for this in sort of preview or sorry, review of the case and oral argument and sort of the pieces that are fitting together there. I really appreciate you sharing your valuable expertise and insight this afternoon. We can wrap it early and give everybody back a portion of their afternoons. So I'll also say thank you to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.